thank you for joining us today.
Today I have Dr. Jane Tillman. She is the Evelyn Stephenson Neff Director of the Erickson Institute. She works to develop existing and new programs to support psychoanalytic education, training, scholarship, research, interdisciplinary studies, and advocacy that contribute to knowledge about human development across the lifespan and the ways identity is shaped in various sociocultural and historical contexts. Dr. Tillman works at the Austin Riggs Center in Massachusetts. Her scholarship and research is on international forums, including seminars, lectures, conferences, and publications. And her research interests include dissociation, psychosis, religion, impasse in treatment, embodiment, clinical and professional ethics, and a bunch of other things. Dr. Tillman, I wanted to have you on for a few reasons. One, I am very interested in psychiatric hospitals and the way that they're ran and managed and the type of care that's offered. I'm also very interested in psychoanalysis. And so I found Austin Riggs, and it seems that they have a very, very big emphasis on psychodynamic treatment there. So I wanted to kind of have you on and talk a little bit about a lot of these different things. And also, I go to Regent University, which tries to practice spirituality and religious integration in psychology. So I would love to hear your thoughts on that here in a little bit. But can you kind of start by just telling us, let's go back to the beginning. No, can you start by telling us a little bit about Austin Riggs?
Yeah, I'd love to tell you about Austin Riggs. Austin Riggs is a small, not-for-profit psychiatric hospital in Stockbridge, Massachusetts, on Main Street in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. So picture Norman Rockwell, and he has a famous painting, and it looks just like that because there's snow on the ground. It's a gray day, but it pretty much looks the same. So we've been in existence for over 100 years, incorporated in 1919. We specialize in the treatment often for people who have tried a lot of other treatments and the treatments haven't been sufficient. So people come here now after having tried a lot of different treatments, many of which have been helpful but not sufficient enough to allow them to get back into their lives in a way that they want to be in their lives. We are a psychoanalytic hospital in the broadest sense of that term. People come here for a minimum stay of 6 weeks and often stay longer. They get a wonderful assessment, psychological testing, social work and family assessment, psychopharmacology assessment, very thorough assessment. And then we try to get to know the person. What's led up to their troubles, what they hope a good outcome would look like for them, and how they understand their experience. So I think one of the things that makes our treatment deep and meaningful to people is not only our 4 times a week individual psychoanalytic psychotherapy with a doctor on staff, but our therapeutic community program, which is based on a philosophy of examined living. So in an era where loneliness is a public health problem now, and we think about that, to have a chance to learn in community with other people is really important. It's a big source of our treatment program. And the other thing is we're an open setting. We don't have any locks, seclusion, restraints, privilege system. People are free to come and go. We have to make sure our patients are appropriate for that kind of responsibility. With all that freedom comes a lot of responsibility. So to be a fully open, and we mean it, fully open setting, I think gives our patients a chance to take the skills they're learning in treatment and put them into practice out there.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. How long have you been at Austin Riggs?
I came to Austin Riggs in July of 1995. So soon to be 29 years.
Oh, wow. Yeah. 30th anniversary coming up, huh?
Yeah.
I saw that you did your postdoctoral fellowship there as well.
I did. We have a four-year postdoctoral fellowship for psychologists and psychiatrists right now. And it's hospital-based psychoanalytic training. So fellows come for 4 years and they see a steady stream of patients in four times a week individual treatment and participate in didactic seminars, supervision. If they have time or interest, develop their own research and writing projects. It's a very rich fellowship. Hard work in a lot of ways, but very rich.
I saw that you all offer a fellowship, and there's not a whole lot of, especially more formalized postdoc training opportunities where you can get psychoanalytic training, and especially at a hospital, right?
Right. I mean, it's totally unique. It's not your standard psychoanalytic training in that it's not fully outpatient, although many patients stay longer and transition to outpatient work and outpatient analytic work. So it's a process. One of the things we work with all our patients on is what's getting in the way of being in an engaged, meaningful, manageable outpatient treatment.
Yeah. And I saw that you also I thought you said it's 4 years, the postdoc
is
4 years.
It's 3 years. Wow. It takes a while to become a psychoanalyst. And 4 years in traditional psychoanalytic education is quick.
Uh-huh.
You know, many, many analytic institutes, people are in training much longer than that. But we have a captive audience in analytic training in traditional institutes. People take courses a couple of nights a week and they analyze three patients. We have fellows here 40, maybe 50 hours a week. Seeing a variety of patients, some shorter term, some longer term. So it's an experience really of immersion.
I didn't realize that it was like a psychoanalytic certification process type program.
We're accredited. There's technicalities in the field, differences between accreditation and certification. Programs are accredited and people get certified. So people graduate from our program and then they're eligible to go to an external certifying board. The American Board of Professional Psychology has a certifying board in psychoanalysis, and the American Board of Psychoanalysis also is a individual certifying agency. And our fellows have been certified by one or the other, or sometimes both of those boards.
Oh, wow. That's awesome. I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
Where did you get your psychoanalytic certification or schooling?
At Austin Riggs primarily. And I also am a graduate of the Berkshire Psychoanalytic Institute, which had a brief history here in Stockbridge and was affiliated with the American Psychoanalytic Association. But Riggs is the primary source of my training.
Oh, okay. What sparked your interest in psychoanalysis, and why the interest in like serious mental illness or psychosis, like hospital work?
I think in terms of psychoanalysis, I think it's a treatment of depth. It seeks to understand people and their suffering in the fullest possible way, beyond a kind of superficial symptom reduction model. And reducing symptoms is important because that's one of the things that leads people to suffer. But understanding some of the sources and the causes of that suffering are important. And the idea that we have an unconscious and there are things outside of our awareness that lead us to repeat certain patterns or behaviors, some helpfully and some not so helpfully. I think history has meaning. And there's debate within psychoanalysis about where to place the emphasis on culture and history, but certainly the Erikson Institute, named for Erik Erikson, really places a value on culture and context in shaping individual identity and development. So I have a keen interest in history. And all our patients, when they're admitted and we do our assessments, we take at least a three-generation family history, and you can really see the complexity of family context that people come from. And sometimes, you may have heard of this, one person in the family is unconsciously perhaps nominated by the family to carry a lot of symptoms, a lot of distress on behalf of the family. And so understanding that and the meanings of that to the person and to their family can be very powerful and moving.
Yeah. I have heard of that. I've heard of, there was a very rich story. I'm not going to be able to remember it very well, but I had heard about a family who was escaping Auschwitz, like during World War II, and they immigrated to America, and the daughter was a redhead, I guess. And like at some point during the whole event, they let her go because they took favor upon her and like let her go. And ever since then, she was kind of like the special child of the family. And as a result, the way that her parents took care of her and brought her up and her with the siblings, and it was kind of like there was too much pressure on her growing up, and that she ended up in a psychiatric hospital and they did family therapy with the family. And it was a very interesting, you know, all of these factors at play.
The situation really well, where context of war, the Holocaust, certainly a number of third, fourth, now fifth generation Holocaust survivors has such a large imprint on people's development and the conscious and unconscious meanings they make of their place in the family, their place in history, their place in the culture.
Yeah. And so you do a lot of family therapy there as well?
When indicated, primarily individual psychotherapy and psychoanalytic psychotherapy, but certainly for every patient who's admitted, family history, family assessment, family meetings, and include the family for family therapy if people are agreeable to that.
Oh.
And it's a lot easier now with Zoom. We used to do a lot by telephone, but Zoom makes it easy. And sometimes if people have family in the area, they can make a trip up here to Stockbridge. But our patients come from all over the country and the world.
Well, the world too, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, I want to segue into that in a second. But also, where did why the interest in hospital work and like psychosis and SMI?
I love working at Austin Riggs. And part of it is I like working in a community of colleagues who are intellectually alive, engaged. The clinical work is interesting. But I think to treat people with serious difficulties, it helps to have a professional community, a holding environment for the work. And that's been important to me. Our patients, many of whom are significantly troubled, high risk, between 40 and 50% have a history of a lifetime suicide attempt prior to admission to Riggs, psychosis, other problems. And it does take a village, and it takes a village not only for the patient, but I think for me, at least as a psychoanalyst, it takes a village for me to have the resources available that I have here in our nursing staff and our substance use services staff, other therapists, psychiatrists, social workers, our kitchen staff, our facilities staff. We're a community in the largest sense of the world, and that word, and that we're just trying to come together in a way to focus on what it means to live in society in this particular community and help our patients.
Yeah, this might be nitpicky, but I'm curious, like, did you hear about Austin Riggs and then decide that you wanted to get training there and work there? And then out of that, your interest in working with this population or psychosis or SMI grew, or was it the other way around?
I did my graduate training at the University of Tennessee
in
Knoxville. And one of our professors there, Jim Gorney, taught a seminar. And we read a couple of papers that had been written by people who had been on the staff at Austin Riggs and treatment. And it was fascinating, totally fascinating. And Jim's enthusiasm for the experience. I had never heard of the Berkshires. I'm from the South. I didn't even know how to say the word Berkshires and Berkshires, whatever. But the work was fascinating, and I was thrilled. You know, I would say one of the best days of my life was getting an offer to come to the fellowship. So I was thrilled to get that offer and to come, and it suited me. It's not for everyone. I had called. I did my internship at Dartmouth, and there had been an intern at Dartmouth who had gone on to be a fellow at Riggs. So the training director, Stan Rosenberg at Dartmouth, put me in touch with this person so I could do a little reconnaissance before I came down to interview to figure out, you know, just what is this place? And he described it to me. He said, it's kind of like a monastery. It's a sort of monastic life. You're all in community, working hard together in a kind of remote, insulated way. And the interview is going to be about, do you fit this community? Can you stand the intensity of this kind of work? And, you know, will it be a good fit?
Wow. That's cool. It sounds very idyllic the way it's like you said, the Norman Rockwell, it's in Massachusetts, you know, it's very beautiful. And then you're in like a kind of like a monastic community, all serving the people.
It's tough though. I don't, you know, that does sound romantic the way I described it, but my training director, John Muller, once described this as a constantly failing utopia, you know, and sometimes we refer to it as a dystopia. But this is tough work. People come here with serious problems. There are many are trying to decide if they want to live or not. So you're right at the edge a lot of times with some of the most, difficult questions people can face.
Yeah, and that's a good segue. You mentioned earlier that a lot of the patients that end up coming, they've tried treatments that haven't worked. And I don't know if you mentioned this, but I saw it on the website where it says that it's known, Austin Riggs is known for a place where treatment resistant patients go.
Yeah.
So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that and just in general, talk about that, but kind of what I'm thinking is, what do you think about the label treatment resistant? Why do people who have been labeled that, why do they go to Austin Riggs, and how does Austin Riggs help them in a way that they haven't been helped before?
That's a great question. So we've gone back and forth over this, what treatment resistant means. Comes out of the psychiatric literature of treatment-resistant depression, right? These are people who have depression that doesn't respond to multiple medication trials, multiple modalities of treatment. So we get the concept from there, but for our purposes, it's complicated. Is it that the patient is resistant, their illness is resistant, or is the treatment itself resistant to what the patient is bringing? Many treatments these days focus on symptoms and symptom checklists, and they resist hearing the meaning of the symptoms or the full history of a person's life. It's hard in today's pressured environment to have the luxury and the time to take a really detailed life history. Most people who go see a therapist or a physician have a symptom history taken, and symptoms are targeted. So it's a little old school to take a detailed life history, but I think sometimes we get patients here who have been through umpteen treatments and they say, nobody ever asked me what it was like when my uncle died by suicide and what that did to our family.
Wow.
And so it takes time to hear those stories, to make space for them. Something like my uncle's suicide that affected our whole family would generally not come up in a more targeted treatment or a more symptom-focused treatment. So I think how people put their stories together and all the complexity is really important. So sometimes the treatments have been resistant to people, especially this focus on very short-term treatments where you really can't get into things too much in depth or short-term, a cycle of short-term hospitalizations. There have been more empirical studies here, and our patients have between 5 and 6, probably more DSM diagnoses. What does that mean? That means they're suffering a lot in a lot of different domains. People are more than a collection of diagnoses. They're people with histories and psychologies and their own unique unconscious and their own family dynamics. So to look at people as a sort of collection of diagnoses sometimes misses the bigger picture. You need sometimes not only a really granular view of a person in their detail, but also a view where you can step back and see the big picture.
Yeah, and even just how you said earlier that Austin Riggs, you'll gather a 3 generations back family history. That sounds unheard of in most other hospital settings.
Yeah, it takes time, but it's so meaningful. And a lot of times, what's so interesting is a lot of times, particularly if we have a younger patient and we're getting a family history from their parents, a lot of times the patient doesn't know the full history of the family. There are things that have not been talked about, things that are not known, that turn out to have great meaning within families. The silences, the people who've been cut out or erased in families, traumatic events, not knowing there's a suicide in the family, or saying, I think this was a suicide, but people called it something else. So the secrets that various members of the family hold become really important and meaningful.
That reminds me of, I can't think of her name right now. She wrote the book, it's a book called The Schizophrenia Complex. And she wrote about her son being diagnosed with schizophrenia. And it wasn't until then that she found out that, I think it was her aunt had also been diagnosed with schizophrenia, but the family had buried it. And no one talked about that diagnosis. And yeah, stuff like that, that's going to come out when something like, yeah.
Well, and you know, lots of mental health problems have been so stigmatized. That's decreasing. But this stigma has led to erasure and silence and shame and disavowal and disguise. And I think over time, for certain people, that can really take a toll.
Yeah.
My colleague, Jeremy Ridenour, writes a lot about psychotic disorders in a very humanistic way, talking about grief and loss and loneliness and trying to bring a kind of humanism back into understanding and treating people with psychotic sorts of disorders.
What was his name?
Jeremy Ridenour. He's publishing Up a Storm right now, and the papers are beautiful and helpful, I think. He's a very clear writer and thinker.
Okay. I'll have to check those out, yeah. And that's what the schizophrenia complex was about. Not only do people diagnosed with schizophrenia now have that diagnosis, but then it's how do they feel about that diagnosis and all of that, maybe the stigma, the shame that's all compiled on top of it. And then how do we feel about this person's diagnosed with schizophrenia and how do we react toward that? So all of that just compounding. I wanted to ask too about, I saw that maybe this is a question for a psychiatrist, but I'm sure that you're more knowledgeable than I am. So I want to ask you about I saw on the website it talks about psychodynamic psychopharmacology and that Austin Riggs is practicing that. Can you tell us what that is?
Yeah. My colleague David Mintz has just published a book on psychodynamic psychiatry and is busy teaching that concept to psychiatrists. Look, medication has meaning and medication effects have meanings. There's some people who will have side effects to every medication. That sets up a relationship between a prescriber and a patient that basically the patient experiences the psychiatrist is harming them every step of the way with all these terrible side effects. So there's a relational meaning that evolves. There are some patients who David talks about the nocebo and the placebo response. that people were going to have a negative response to medications and people were going to have a placebo response. You know, the medication feels magic to them. This pill really works. This worked. My mother took this. I don't want to take that. Or my father took that. I definitely want to take that. You know, there's a lot of meaning and meaning effects in medication that David has written about and certainly much more knowledgeable than I am. But I think most psychiatrists who are prescribing know something about medication having meaning to people and the prescribing relationship having meaning, but having a framework and a way to think about it and a way to talk about it with patients is really important. Because, you know, like I said, our patients have often had many other treatments that haven't worked. And so trying to slow it all down and go frame by frame and try to figure out what things mean and how they're responded to step by step becomes very important when you have people who've had a lot of treatment and need a second look or a different kind of look.
Yeah. Yeah, that's cool. I had never heard of psychiatrists practicing that way and thinking about the medication has meaning and the symptoms have meaning. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you know of any other hospitals that practice in a similar way to Austin Riggs?
You know, there are other residential treatments. Residential treatment is an intermediate level of care, somewhere between hospitals, somewhere between IOP and partial hospitalization. So there are plenty of other residential programs, and there are other programs that have an emphasis on community living. Gould Farm, right down the road from us, oldest therapeutic community program in the country. And their patients are referred to as guests there. And It's a lovely therapeutic community. They don't do the intensive psychotherapy and aren't psychoanalytically oriented the way we are. But Cooper Reese in North Carolina, sort of in the Gould Farm model, another therapeutic community program. So there are the Lindner Center for Hope in Ohio. So there are other programs that aren't exactly like ours, but are residential and focus on community-based treatment.
And do you know, so people get labeled as treatment-resistant. They come to Austin Riggs for help that maybe other treatments haven't been working for them. Do you know what your outcomes are like?
You know, we have successes and failures, and we have the in-between. Generally, our patients and our patient satisfaction surveys and ratings of care improve. We have a measurement-based care initiative that looks at symptom change, brief symptom inventory, other empirical measures, and patients report improvement over the course of our treatment. Sometimes they don't feel so great at the time they're leaving. It's hard to leave a community. It's hard to leave a treatment like this. It's hard to know that you still have work ahead of you. I wouldn't say that Austin Riggs patients leave symptom-free, but I think they leave with a sense of a way of thinking about their troubles and hopefully able to engage in a meaningful, more longer-term outpatient treatment. So we have favorable outcomes for the majority of our patients, but certainly not all. And then, you know, maybe our treatment approach isn't right for everyone and they go to other things. But a lot of our patients have been through DBT and have learned their DBT skills, which are very helpful. DBT teaches great skills, and those skills are very helpful, but maybe not enough to get at some of the meaning, but very effective at helping to manage some of the distressing feelings. So each step along the way, hopefully a person is learning something about themselves and their difficulties, not only what doesn't work, but what might.
Yeah, I was curious about the outcomes, and if you like, that makes sense. It's not gonna work for everybody. Do you guys have people that come back?
We do have people that come back. And that's a big deal. And we don't see that as failure. And we hope, you know, some people sometimes feel like that. But I think people are trying to get hold of some really difficult problems. So people do come back. And we have some people here now who have been here before, who have maybe come back after years, maybe come back after months.
Yeah, but that's, yeah, I think I'm getting a feel for it. Like, would you, this might be too personal of a question, not for you, but for Austin Riggs. There's a lot of hospitals or maybe programs. There's a lot of work that goes into this. Like you said, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of energy, a lot of mental effort. And you're seeing people 3-4 times a week. Staff. Does staff get like, is there like, what's staff burnout like, or what's the environment like? Yeah. Can you
that's a great question. You know, it comes and goes, and there's a little bit of contagion. So sometimes people can feel a high level of burnout, particularly when we've had some real high acuity patients, or you know, COVID has taken its toll on people, you know, because there are always people on the staff rotating out sick with COVID. And so people have to work harder to cover for that, and that takes its toll. So I would say before COVID, there wasn't a lot of burnout. Since COVID, that's been tough in some ways. And it helps that the rest of the world is on fire. I guess, you know, it doesn't feel quite so. Austin Riggs is on fire. It feels like Austin Riggs is in a world that's on fire. And we're doing the best we can. We're doing pretty well. Our staff retention is high. But burnout is certainly not unheard of.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Thanks. Do you do much? I imagine the answer to this is yes, but do you do much psychotherapy for psychosis? Like, if people come, do people come currently in a psychotic state or having hallucinations or delusions that you work through their delusions with them, or?
Yeah, I again, it's an open setting. Mm-hmm. So people have to be able to be in touch with reality enough to maintain their safety. Mm-hmm. We have, and delusions tend to be their own category. You know, people who are simply delusional or have fixed delusions often are higher function than other types of psychotic disorders, where people might be more disorganized, impulsive, not so in control of themselves. So, you know, the psychotic disorders have such a huge spectrum. But we do, everyone who comes to Riggs is in a 4 times a week treatment. Everyone. So it's not you get 4 times a week, but your problem is just a twice a week problem. It's 4 times a week for everyone for the whole time they're here across our continuum of care. And the work with people with severe psychotic disorders can be challenging, right? And some ways, the grief, the loss, the alienation, the loneliness, the stigma, and being with a person in that as they experience that and feel all those feelings is very moving. It's very challenging and heartbreaking at times, and also very rewarding at times. So it's, you know, it's such a full range of experience, I think, for patients, for families, for staff, but it's very hard work.
Yeah. Do you guys use the couch?
You know, it's up to the patient. Some patients do, some don't. I think we're neither here nor there about it. In some way, whatever the patient feels will be helpful to them.
Nice. And you got your degree in divinity?
I did.
Yeah, wow. What, tell us a little bit about that.
Okay, Eric Erickson's great notion or concept of a moratorium. early adulthood, young adults have a moratorium, you know, maybe in this culture, it's called college, where you can go and try different things out and figure out something about your identity, what you like, what you don't, what you thought you liked, what it turns out you don't, those sorts of things. So I would describe myself as having a nice Ericksonian moratorium in my 20s where I did a lot of things. So I worked as a research assistant in cardiothoracic surgery at the University of North Carolina. I went to Divinity School at Duke University. I was a flight paramedic for a little over 3 years in a very busy trauma service on a helicopter. And then in my late 20s, I went to graduate school. But I loved all those things. I learned a lot. It was exciting. Friendships that will last a lifetime, I think, in those contexts. So, but it took me a while to get to clinical psychology.
But you
and then it
way.
Took a little while to get to psychoanalysis. So, you know, but I'm all in favor of the moratorium.
Yeah, it sounds like you lived a very adventurous 20s.
Yeah.
Yeah. The flight paramedic, the helicopter, that sounds really cool.
Yeah, I love that, John. I love the people I work with. It was very intense. It was scary a lot of the times. Sad, exciting, you know, sort of instant gratification sometimes.
Yeah. You said that it took you a while to get to clinical psychology. What was it that led you to clinical psychology?
I think trying to figure out, what am I doing here? What am I doing in my 20s? Why am I doing all this? What's the meaning of this? And developing some curiosity for why I'm doing these various things. Some of the helicopter job, you know, has, especially at that time, it's a little bit high risk. And trying to think about that. And trying to put together really disparate interests. In religion and theology and ethics. And I thought, you know, psychoanalysis has a home for all of those kinds of ideas and concerns. It really is the place where you can approach understanding unconscious meanings of so many different things, of art, of music, of science, medicine, psychology, you know, it's a big tent.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that was my main draw too. I forget the quote. I think it was Freud, but someone was asking, it might have been Anna Freud, but someone was asking, I want to be a psychoanalyst. How should I prepare myself? And they were like, read literature, read poets, read religious myths.
Essay on lay analysis and about the well-educated analyst, you know, a sort of classical humanist education.
Yeah. So many varied interests all coming together in one
spot. Yeah.
Yeah. So cool. And so are you still, have you found the answers? Do you know what you're doing?
Some days, sometimes. No, I haven't found the answers, but I think I've found a meaningful life.
Good, good. Can you talk a little bit about how you've dealt with religion and psychology, and maybe did you deal with trying to integrate the two? Do you like working with religious problems in therapy? Do you think that it should be separate? Like, how do you handle that?
Yes. it's complicated. I certainly don't have the answer for it. These are two parts of my life that I have, in the professional and the external world, kept very far apart. I think for important reasons. There's one has a particular role and task in psychoanalysis, that is quite different from the role and task of a religious life and a religious person. There's some crossover, but you have to be clear about the differences and the different aims, which I try to be. in some ways. I do think both try to understand something about our relationships, about suffering, about history, about community, about stories, origin stories. You know, different religions have origin stories. The origin story in psychoanalysis is Oedipus. Traumatic story, traumatic origins. So I do think a lot about that. There's some people I think who integrate those aspects of their life a little better than I have. I'm a work in progress in that area.
Yeah, I'd be curious, and we can switch topics if you'd like, but a lot of this is like personal. But I also have taken an interest in like Jungian psychoanalysis or thought, and I know he would say that like especially spirituality in general, spirituality can't be divorced from psychology, like the work that you do, psychotherapy, and I think he said that. At one point, at least, he said that if his patients got into a religious, like a church, or belonging to a community, a religious organization, then he would no longer deem psychoanalysis appropriate for them. Like they can find what they need there. I might not have that wrong.
Yeah, I don't know that story. I wish I knew more about Jung than I have a very superficial view of that, so I don't know that story. But I think there obviously in Freud's writings and beyond, there's a tension between religion and the Marxist idea of opiate for the masses, kind of attitude at the turn of the century, which I think is understandable. I think there could be some truth to that. At times, and religion. But of course, the great correspondence. I mean, this is Freud and his correspondence with Oscar Pfister, who is a pastor and a Reformed pastor, and they had a great correspondence. Wrote letters back and forth as they, Freud's. Late 1920s text of the future of an illusion, Pfister responds to and writes the illusion of a future, which is from the religion point of view. So I think keeping the channels open for conversations about commonalities and clear differences is important.
Yeah. Was it Pfister who said Freud was one of the best Christians he knew?
I think so.
I just recently came across
criticism or some kind of respect. It's hard to know.
Yeah. I came across yesterday this the International Society for Psychological and Social Approaches to Psychosis or Psychoses, the ISPIS US. Have you heard of that organization?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
That is a long history, very important history of people, I think, who are trying to understand the meaning of psychosis and a humanistic approach to psychosis versus a strict medical model. So very important thinkers. My colleague Marilyn Charles here has been very involved in that organization.
Okay, thanks. That's helpful.
Yeah.
And then I guess last question. When it comes to in a lot of ways, I think that psychology over the past 20, 30 years, a lot of it switching to, like you said, the symptom reduction based care, managed care. We've been pretty steeped in the medical model of care, more about the brain and finding genes and all of this stuff. And as a psychoanalyst and someone working with the population that you work with, what are you hopeful about and what are you pessimistic about?
I'm hopeful about the research. I think the gene research is important, but we're learning something about gene by environment interaction. And our medical director, CEO Eric Plakin, has really taken on that gene by environment interaction is really important. The environment matters, but people's biology matters as well. Eric's also a great advocate for access to care and the enforcement of the parity law and difficulties in the insurance industry. But in terms of, am I optimistic or pessimistic? I think sometimes I'm pessimistic around our insurance industry in some ways and the barriers to care that people face. That is a big uphill climb. You know, the healthcare system in America is really strained. We have a lot more people in need of care and resources to access that care are limited. I'm optimistic in terms of science and research and the challenges ahead in that way. My colleague, Katie Lewis, is our director of research, and her research is on suicide, but also on loneliness and social interaction and attachment. And I think she's learning really important things that help us think and understand our patients better. So I feel optimistic about that. I feel optimistic for psychoanalysis, which has been kind of rigid and closed off and isolated, and I think is opening up and is including the social and the cultural context more, which we've always done at Riggs. But I think in mainstream psychoanalysis in this country, that is a more recent acceptance that history and culture and the social matter. I don't know. There are too many people arguing with that. I mean, where to place the emphasis is mostly the debate now, how much to emphasize intrapsychic organization of the individual mind and how much to place an emphasis on so-called the social, on social dynamics. But I think that will work itself out over time. It's a painful time in psychoanalysis right now that I think is expectable. It means we're in the world, which is in a painful place right now. So we're in that conversation, which I think is hopeful.
Yeah, good. Good. Do you see a lot of young people still interested in psychoanalysis?
Yes. I mean, in my generation, you know, not so much interest in my generation, but yes, in young people, I really do. I see a passion for it. I see it coming back, particularly in psychiatrists who want to do something meaningful, young psychiatrists. It's a little harder for psychologists right now. I think the training is further and further away from being able to think more humanistically at times. But I do, I think our hope is in younger people who want to, I mean, climate change, loneliness, social upheaval, war. There is a lot to try to understand and work on and work with. And certainly at a systems level, at a group level, I think people are seeing the group level dynamics as so important. And psychoanalysis has something to say about that.
All right, Dr. Tillman, I want to thank you again for coming on to talk about these things. I've enjoyed getting to know you a little bit better and know more about Austin Riggs.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me. This is very interesting, and I'll be interested to hear how your work is going and your podcast is coming.
Yeah, thank you.